Steve.
I'm here. Hello, everyone. And today I'm going to be talking about European defence and a little bit of time for some real talk here. And as I promised last week, I'm going to be reading an article by my buddy Morgoth on his Substack, Morgoth's Review. So I'll just pull this up here, where he basically outlines a few concerns he has with what he's been seeing in the analysis coming out of some of the channels that we all watch and some of the discourse coming from the liberal side as well, and thinking seriously about what the best European defence strategy should be. He's called it Stuck in the Middle with EU, which is a clever title. There's Ursula von der Leyen there. Let me just read this, and what I'll do is I'll pause. When I think there's something worth saying or adding, I will pause and give some thoughts. Just before we get going, I'll remind everyone, do buy courses at the Academic Agency. Foundations of Shakespeare, of course, is the newest one. Bestseller is The Trivium. Thousands of people have done that at this point. Foundations of Writing, Rhetoric, Logic. Take those courses if you want to, if you're looking for a promotion at work or something, the clear communication, regardless of what you do, really will put you in good stead. If you're looking for which one to start with, I'd start with Foundations of Writing. All right, so let us get going here. So this is Morgoth, and I've linked this in the show notes. If you don't read his Substack, you should give that a subscribe if you're on there as well. Subscribe to me too on there. Although I write less frequently than Morgoth. Morgoth writes quite a lot of articles on there. I'm more like one a month. Anyway, let's carry on. I've spent the last few weeks listening to regime-approved mainstream podcasts on geopolitical matters and discovered many things. One of the things I found is that they know that we call them libtards. I'd love to see that. The other is that they genuinely believe, deep in their hearts, that Vladimir Putin represents a massive and deadly threat to European security. They also think that Donald Trump is an imbecile and, more discreetly, suspect he's under control of Russia. Podcasters at Times Radio, the news agents, Navarra Media, and guests at Unheard, who is it for, seem to live in a loop of stunned disbelief. I began listening to liberal views on geopolitics to understand the counter-arguments to outlets such as The Duran, Judge Napolitano, Neutrality Studies, and The Grey Zone. There comes a point when the pro-Russian narrative framing transcends, sticking it to the libs and revealing itself to be what it is. For a while now, I've begun to sense that the geopolitical discourse in the network I'm part of is a little wonky, tad off kilter in a way that feels ominous and ill-fated. Trips to Russia and podcasts in the Kremlin seemed all well and good during the tsunami of propaganda and bullshit that flowed from Western institutions after Russia invaded Ukraine. Still, now that NATO appears to be breaking apart, it seems more like Alexander Mercurius is instructing J.D. Vance and the White House than speaking objectively to a YouTube audience. It feels great to have articulate people, influential people, to ride the abyss of charisma that is Keir Starmer, or snigger at the ludicrously incompetent managerial females who seem to run European affairs. But what, in this era of profound geopolitical uncertainty, is to become of the Europeans themselves? Very good question. Awful as stupid as they might be, European liberal elites have an answer to this question. Massively boost military spending and somehow arm the continent to the teeth. In all likelihood, given their proclivity towards censorship, this will require even more surveillance authoritarianism. At least it is a plan. The view, and I'll talk more about this, because I am not, as I mentioned last week, I'm not actually against the rearming of Europe at all. Merz, for example, just in this past week, he's going to become the German Chancellor, has said that Germany is back and that Germany is they have basically signed this thing where they are increasing military spending massively, and they are going beyond their fiscal rules. And in Germany, that's a very big deal, because there are these kind of locks in place that, you know, the German parliament, whatever it's called, Reichstag, I don't know what it's called, is meant to stay within these fiscal rules. They've blown that out of the water to increase military spending, which is very interesting. Now, given that Germany is the most vassal, the most weak of all of the European nations, the most vassal to America, it's kind of surprising that they're doing that. Obviously, von der Leyen has pledged to massively increase European military spending. Starmer is gung-ho. Macron is gung-ho. So all of Europe is on the same page when it comes to this defense plan. Whether they are truly working independently or not, I'll get onto, because Brian Baletic's idea, you know, is, as things stand, that this is all actually Pete Hegseth's idea, and that this is actually US policy for Europe to take the lead on Russia, at least in the short term. At the moment, I don't see anything at all that contradicts that. At the time of recording this, maybe something will have happened by the time this comes out. Somehow I doubt it, though. But in the long term, I greatly support Europe kind of re-entering world history in a way after this 80 years of time out that Germany and France and so on have had since World War II. I would actually welcome them coming back onto the world stage. And of course, in order to get a seat at the table, they need to have a decent army. Okay, they don't have one at the moment, but maybe in 10, 15 years, why not? You know, the Europeans can't have a decent military. You know, the Europeans who rule the world for 400 years, of course they can. But anyway, let's carry on with Morgoth's analysis. The view from both MAGA and geopolitical YouTube is that what Russia calls gay rope is a gaggle of warmongering lunatics, though luckily they're too homosexual and feminized to either build anything or field an army. You see, if Europe remains under the American security umbrella, they're parasites who fritter away their economies on immigrants and early pensions. This is true. However, when European leaders dig deep into our pockets and attempt to defend the continent, the same networks and commentators will shriek with horror at how Europe is full of war hawks. So which is it to be? Either Europe remains a set of American vassals, or NATO is sundered and Europe arms itself. Both, it seems, are morally repellent to the geopolitical punditry and MAGA commentariat. Europe should become as toothless militarily as it already is in its immigration policies, a borderless free-for-all. The only security guarantee given is that Donald Trump has copious amounts of bro energy with Putin. Am I about to be a neocon or NAFO shill? No, but I do know when somebody hands me a glass of piss and calls it a pint. Very plain spoken as ever. And I have noticed this curious dichotomy, especially from some of the MAGA crowd. Obviously, we interact with Russians a lot less. We only get to, you know, watch these channels and the interactions of Judge Knapp with Lavrov, or when Dugin goes on a channel or something. I don't know any Russians. But certainly from the MAGA crowd, Morgoth is right that it's like they want to at once lord it over and be like, yeah, you're weak, you're vassals, you know, you do as you're told type thing. And then at the same time, any steps towards rectifying this, or, you know, they don't like that either. So it's like, well, we can't have it both ways, really. And this is something that a number of commentators have pointed to. Frody has been very consistent on this as an example. But there's been others as well, Dickie Spencer, and various other voices that I have always kept an ear to, because, look, I'm a realist, okay? When it comes to the Russia conflict, my analysis has always been the same. Russia is just going to win this because Russia is always going to beat Ukraine 10 times out of 10. Okay. So therefore, with that reality in mind, you need to plan accordingly. Obviously, other analyses are available. But in the long term, I generally think that it's a good idea for Europe to be in charge of its own defense again. I'd love to be alive the day that the last American soldier walks out of Europe. You know, Yankee, go home. I mean, I've always been of that mind. So anyway, when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, John Mearsheimer appeared like a predictive sage, having quite literally done so 10 years prior. Mearsheimer's realist approach to geopolitics has subsequently become the dominant form of analysis in right-leaning circles online. According to Mearsheimer, Western encroachment into Ukraine presented an existential threat to Russia. Whether they wanted to or not, Russia was compelled to invade. Pragmatic self-interest, not ideology, drives the policy of great power politics. Mearsheimer is well regarded in geopolitical YouTube commentary and is very influential. If one had a pro-Kremlin bias, Mearsheimer offers a lucrative and valuable opportunity to present Russian policy as, quote, mere common sense or pragmatism, and perhaps it is. However, I find it rather baffling that those same people never use the Mearsheimer lens when discussing European security interests. Now, this is an interesting passage because I've actually been reading Mearsheimer of late. I've got a book of his here called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, which is like a kind of history of the 19th and 20th centuries, told through the lens of comparing the various great powers. But there are bits where he also kind of ranges forward and talks about modern stuff as well. And the noticeable thing about Mearsheimer is that Mearsheimer, in his analysis, does not actually consider the post-Soviet Russia a threat in any meaningful sense. He actually goes as far as to say in this book that the Russian military is weak, and even if they go on the offensive in Central Europe and so on, they'll be perceived as a threat, but aren't really that much of a threat. For him, the great threat is China. There's a whole chapter here called Can China Rise Peacefully? And in it, he basically says, like, no, the logic of great power politics is that at some point, China is going to start getting really aggressive, and there's nothing that anybody can stop that. So concentrating on Russia when China is in this great kind of poise to be this aggressive power is bad policy, according to Mearsheimer. Now, clearly, the neocons and the West did not listen to him. I think what Mearsheimer wanted to do was to actually hold the Russians close and peel them off the Chinese, so that so that everybody can concentrate on China. That hasn't happened, and now we've got this division of labor idea of Pete Hegseth's, where Europe deals with Russia and America deals with China. Okay, so kind of a little bit of both. But whether Mearsheimer analysis is correct that Russia is weak remains to be seen. But this is a kind of another schizophrenic thing I've noticed in the analysis, though, on the liberal side, which is that, like, when I deal with Tory boys and NAFO types, they're never quite, it's always like, well, Russia's this big threat, but also they're weak and I've underperformed in Ukraine. And, you know, they can't even, like, afraid is the line was they can't even take back Kursk. And I do wonder how much truth there is to that, because they must know that Russia in the state it's in now, with its army now, is not capable of going much further than Ukraine, right? I mean, it's taken 3 years to take 20% of the country, and they still haven't even taken all of the four oblasts. So realistically, they must know that if Putin wanted to crack on and, like, let's say, take Poland, he wouldn't be able to. There's no way that the Russian army could take the Poles as things stand right now. If it took 3 years to take 20% of Ukraine, we're talking about like a 20 year bogged down war there in Poland, right? Especially if all the rest of NATO then piled into Poland, we're talking World War III. It's just not going to happen. So I do wonder whether a lot of the stuff that we're seeing from the likes of Starmer and Macron and the EU at the minute, kind of knows that there's not really going to be this escalation of conflict, but they're using it as a pretext to rearm. That's what I mean. That would be giving the devil his due and assuming that these people aren't completely insane. Maybe that's what they're actually doing. And I'm not actually against it. I think it's a good long-term strategy to rearm. I mean, I'd like to see Europe not only remilitarize, but with it, re-industrialize, right? Bring manufacturing back. I mean, how are you going to build all these? I mean, how are you going to build tanks and munitions and guns and missiles without a manufacturing base? So, you know, maybe it could be used as a pretext to that as well. I mean, who knows? This Merz in Germany, at the same time as he's pledging all this money for the military, he's also hugging the Greens tight and going full board on net zero rubbish. So we'll see what happens, you know. But my hope is that as reality sets in for Europe, it's actually forced to be more realist and less shitlib going forward. And it's starting to creep in. I've noticed it. I mean, I've been watching a few speeches of Mark Carney, you know, the former Bank of England manager who's now the Prime Minister of Canada. And honestly, if I was Canadian, I'd be like, some of those speeches, I can see him winning. You know, they were good speeches, objectively speaking. You know, he's doing the whole Blair strafe right thing, but doing it really well. It's like a masterclass of, you know, strafing their Tory, the Canadian Conservatives, to their right. And he is like, you know, when he even talked about the European heritage of Canadians, you know, that most Canadians are either from Britain or from France, or, you know, they were Native Americans, which was a striking comment from a supposed globalist. So the rhetoric is already changing. And just visually, you know, there are all these videos every day we're getting now of Keir Starmer in a submarine, Keir Starmer in, you know, combat gear. But one of the things you notice about these videos, everybody in them is white. Every single person is white. And obviously at the minute it's a ruse and these people have, you know, they're coming off the back of woke and trans stuff, but let's pretend they carry on that for another 5 years or so, right? There's a weird way in which all of these shitlib leaders could, through containment and through necessity, actually over time transform into being like, you know, actually closer to the sort of leaders we want to see. So there could actually be some good things of this. And this was always the great hope of Dickie Spencer, of course. This is why he's such a big NATO supporter, etc., in theory. Anyway, let's carry on. He says, the statement, this is how the Durand reported it. The statement released by the European Union on defence spending said, the first part of this Rearm Europe plan is to unleash the use of public funding in defence at a national level. Member states were ready to invest more in their own security if they have the fiscal space, but we must enable them to do so. This is why we will shortly propose to activate the National Escape Clause of the Stability and Growth Pact. It will allow member states to increase significantly their defence expenditures without triggering the excessive deficit procedure. For example, if member states would increase their defence spending by 1.5% of GDP on average, this could create fiscal space of close to 650 billion euros over a period of 4 years. The second proposal will be a new instrument. It will provide 150 billion euros of loans to member states for defence investment. This is basically about spending better and spending together. We are talking about pan-European capability domains. For example, air and missile defence, artillery systems, missile and ammunition drones and anti-drone systems, but also to address other needs from cyber to military mobility, for example. It will help member states to pool demand and to buy together. Of course, with this equipment, member states can massively step up their support to Ukraine. so immediate military equipment for Ukraine. This approach of joint procurement will also reduce costs, reduce fragmentation, increase interoperability, and strengthen our defense industrial base. And it can be to the benefit of Ukraine, as I've just described. So this is Europe's moment, and we must live up to it. The Trump administration may quibble about funding for Ukraine. By and large, this is precisely what they wanted. Europeans are now paying for European collective security. And this is also accords with the Brian Balesic analysis that this is basically the Hegseth plan, and Europe is more or less doing what America wanted. Now, there's a flip side. There's a flip side of that, which is that with defense spending comes autonomy. It comes autonomy. With defense spending, obviously now you're not relying on the core of the empire, the imperial core, to pay for everything. So it's only a matter of time before, well, I'm paying for, what do I actually need you for? What am I getting from being part of this empire anymore? And as I mentioned last week, this happened with the British Empire in the 1920s and the 1930s. There was a new policy that the colonies had to pay for their own defense, that the taxation within the colonies would therefore pay for the armies that looked after those places. Well, I mean, it's only a matter of time before you had the nationalist movements, before you had independence movements, and the British Empire broke apart. So even though it could be Trump's plan, I don't think Trump actively wants to break apart the US empire. And clearly, MAGA base people, all you have to do is interact with them on Twitter. Clearly, they don't really want that either. Just have to listen to read the things they say. But the reality is that will follow. You know, once you've got your own army, you can then start thinking in other sorts of ways. The other thing is that, you know, if you think about traditional metrics, okay, yes, the economy, but there's also something called manpower. And the Europe as a collective actually has better manpower than both Russia and America, has almost double the US population. I think it's like 715 million people in Europe, and what is it, about closer to 350, 400 in the USA, especially if Canada and the ancillary, the so-called CANZAC, aligns with Europe as opposed to aligns with America. You know, the collective West minus USA is still a massive population. Okay, still a massive population. If they got their act together, okay, which is a big if from where things are right now, there's nothing actually stopping that unit, that big 750 million mass of population, you know, becoming a major power. Why not? Bigger than Russia, population-wise, bigger than America, population-wise. Okay, and these are the sorts of realities that the Russians or the Americans won't like being pointed out. They actually love the idea of a weak Europe. They love the idea of Europe not having a military and Europe just being incapable to defend it, like literally just a kind of minnow. And this is the sort of language I've started to notice on some of these channels, like on Judge Knapp and so on, where they talk about how Europe is reverting to its historical status as just a stop off on the Silk Road, you know, just the terminus of the Silk Road, and that the center of action has moved from Europe, Western Europe, to Eurasia or just Asia. Okay. And this is actually talked about in many different books that I have covered that were written just after World War II, that this, you know, this drift would happen away from Europe, which had 400 years on top, but now it's going to be the turn of China or the turn of America, etc. And The truth is that the Americans and the Russians are kind of quite happy with that development. Both of them, for different reasons, are happy with that development. But Europe, from its own point of view, if it's going to have self-interest, if it's going to re-enter world history, if it's going to survive, cannot actually be happy with that development. This is the Mia Shimer for me and not for thee part, right? From its own point of view, there's no reason why it shouldn't pursue that policy in the long term. Anyway, Morgoth returns. Geopolitical YouTube has three narratives in response to this. One, it cannot be done because Europe is deindustrialized backwater and able to innovate. Two, the liberal elites who govern Europe should not be fleecing their populations when they could better spend the money on infrastructure and care, etc. Or three, the liberal elites who rule Europe are engaging in dangerous rhetorical games and escalating tensions needlessly. In other words, Europe, devoid of the American security umbrella, should remain demilitarized. Instead, and this is a good point. I mean, I don't agree in the long term with any of those things. Those things may be true as of right now, but that doesn't mean that they should remain true in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. And, you know, this is the advantage that the Chinese and the Russians have. They can look 10, 20 years down the line. And in a strange way, the non-democratic aspect of the EU, figures like Tony Blair as well, who are just not Democrats, Ursula von der Leyen and so on, they are able, because they don't really have to care about elections that much because they're just the permanent ruling class, they also can think in the 10-year, 20-year, 30-year horizon. And a question would have to be, especially in this country, because of Brexit, you're meant to be automatically skeptical of that. You're meant to automatically dislike that. But why? Why? I mean, seriously, why? Europe is going to, like, why do you want a weak Europe if you're sitting here in Blighty? Is a good question. I mean, clearly Starmer is aligning himself with that lot and not with the USA at this moment. Anyway, let's carry on. Instead, European nations should wriggle free of the liberal elites and collective interests and deal one-on-one with countries such as Russia, America, and China. I suspect that if staunch nationalists or conservatives rule the EU rather than Ursula and her cronies, geopolitical YouTube would be even more contemptuous. Thus, unlike China, Russia, or the United States, Europe's role is to be subservient to one power or another, or to dissolve its collective security interests entirely. But that's fine, because Trump vibes well with Putin. These are all fantastic points from Morgoth. You've got no disagreement from me. I kind of absolutely, this should not be what Europe is doing. Now, again, I have to draw the distinction between the short-term Russia situation right now and the long-term picture in the 10, 20, 30-year time span. Because Europe should absolutely be doing the moves that it is doing right now. You know, I call this, what is the best defense strategy? The best defense strategy is becoming as independent as possible, as quickly as possible, getting out from under the lesbian stiletto of the Americans, so that it's able basically to call its own shots. One of the things about the Ukraine war, of course, was that the Germans under Merkel were going towards the Russians. This is what Nord Stream was about. And of course, the Americans nixed that. The Americans destroyed that and have destroyed European-Russian relations. Because if you're Europe, you're caught between, you know, the bear and the eagle, they used to call it. They're caught between the bear and the eagle. Well, there's a choice. You can actually go towards the bear if you wanted to. That's been destroyed now. The reality is that project is dead. The Americans killed it. But, you know, with a strong European military, Europe will then again have more options, you know, and let's say in the future it might decide, well, sod America. America is an explicitly anti-European power now. We'll make our own alliances. We'll stand alone, or maybe even after a certain amount of time, the European mind will turn towards, its historical norm, which is expansionist. Who knows? But the Morgoth is right that the narratives coming out of America and Russia are both, no, none of this is allowed. Europe has to stay cucked and weak and, subservient and so on. But like I said, there's no actual reason for that to be the case, right? Other than the fact that it has been weakened after World War II, after basically 80 years of American occupation after World War II, right? Europe lost the war. America won the war, if you want to put it that way, right? But all of that era is ending now. That's a distance, almost 100 years ago at this point. So anyway, let's carry on. Recently, American podcaster Judge Napolitano enjoyed a trip to Russia, where Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov quipped that Führer Ursula is mobilizing everybody to remilitarize Europe. The language, of course, is reminiscent of the justifications to, quote, denazify Ukraine. Former CIA analyst and Judge Napolitano regular Larry Johnson gushed fawningly over that Lavrov is the Metternich of the 21st century, and indeed superior to Metternich. Yet again, from the perspective of Mearsheimer-style realism, why should the EU not have security interests? The budget clearly denotes that it will be spread across the next 4 years. It is not merely a conduit to funnel more arms and potentially men into Ukraine, but a general defense policy, post-American security guarantees. Ironically, it is the liberal, regime-friendly podcasters who more correctly apply Mearsheimer's logic. They argue that in a world of great power blocks, it is obviously against European interests to remain undefended and reliant on what they see in Donald Trump as a liability and an incompetent buffoon. Now, we have to remember here that Mearsheimer is American, and therefore his analysis is from the American point of view. And what Morgoth is pointing towards here is that American interests are not European interests. And in fact, if you have a look at the long history of American-European geopolitical relations, American interests are never European interests. Okay, Scott Ritter said recently, as I mentioned in another video, that Europe is the enemy of America. But many people would reverse that and say America is being the enemy of Europe. These are just kind of cold, hard, in the cold light of day, these have been the actions. And I've mentioned many, many books here, How Europe Became American by Hans Vogel, Homo Americanus by Tomislav Sunik, Vassal State by Angus Hanton, How America Conquers Britain, L. Denny, Exporting the American Model by Jelic. I mean, I've mentioned all these books time and time again. The books by Major General Richard Hilton, especially Imperial Obituary, very good on this topic. The Biggs one, The Uncertain Ally by Biggs Davison. All right, these are all it's not like European patriots or British patriots have not been onto this for a very long time. Right, they have been onto it. The emergent trust me, bro, guarantees to a continent begin to ring hollow when one questions where the Trump administration is getting its geopolitical influences. At the same time, it is impossible to deny that the current crop of European elites is the most corrupt, anti-white, feminine, stupid, and incompetent in its civilization's long history. When in history has it ever been thought of as a virtue for Europeans to stand utterly passive and defenseless on the world stage? Great point. If, for example, a series of nationalist victories across the continent resulted in the sweeping away of the liberal elites, would it still be deemed immoral not to have robust armies and militaries? Yet there exists a network of highly competent influencers with massive audiences who deliver a relentless churn of content that frames narratives for us, despite contradicting their stances on Russia and countering the realism they profess to believe in. I'm increasingly reminded of the film Hannibal, which differs from the book. Hannibal Lecter's wealthy victim, Mason Verger, plots to lure out Lecter by orchestrating a public humiliation campaign against Clarice Starling. Starling is used as bait, though in Verger's calculations, Lecter will emerge to gloat and enjoy her torment. It is commonly known that Western liberal elites are widely despised, and there's an audience to lure out and enjoy that being articulated. We want to see them distressed. It is good to see them, as Alexander Mercurius relishes as saying, scared and confused. But I cannot only ignore the bum notes for so long. I can only ignore the absence of mass immigration as a factor of European instability and not everything resulting from the Ukraine war for so long. I can only pretend not to notice the duper's delight grin for so long. I can only push Mason Verger's line, when the fox hears the rabbit scream, he comes a-running, but not to help, out of my mind for so long. So that was a very good article, in my view, thoughtful article by Morgoth. And hopefully I articulated some of my... I basically agree with a lot of what he said there. The only caveat I put to that is that there is a difference between what can be achieved right now, right, and what can be achieved in the long term. I also think that what is happening right now, as I've said, as per Brian Balletic's analysis, is going according to the US plan. The US is still the boss right now. And everything that we've been seeing from Starmer and Macron and so on is all part of Pete Hegseth's plan. As Morgoth said, it's part of what Trump wanted. But what Trump wants, which could be driven by necessity and realities of the American budget, of the American, maybe America's just overextended at the moment, as I talked about yesterday. The reality is that America has diminished as a power. America is no longer respected as it once was. It's no longer as powerful as it once was. And it is withdrawing. And when that happens, right, that is the late stage of the empire. And the colonies start to pay for themselves. It's only a matter of time then before they start to break away from the hegemon. Now, that's not going to happen in the short term. But maybe this Ukraine war is being used as the pretext to go along those lines. Very interested recently by Ursula von der Leyen saying that she, I kind of even thought it was a bit based, actually. She said that the US arms contractors are going to be cut out of the remilitarization of Europe, right? It's going to be done using European contractors, not using American ones. Unfortunately, they did also cut out the British arms contractors, but there's nothing stopping Starmer saying, look, we're going to make the arms ourselves, right? And everybody like, well, what were you in whose factories? Just build some factories, because that's what they need to do, basically. They need to re-industrialize in some places. Are these lot, who Morgoth rightly also points out, are clowns, feminine clowns, going to do that? Well, it's hard to say. If you look at the actions of Mertz, it's like he says one thing and then he also like hugs the Greens tights and talks about net zero. At the minute, we've still got Ed Miliband committing us to a suicidal net zero plan. Blair has shot him down a number of times in public, but as things stand, Miliband is still there. So until that net zero bit is gone, and we know they're not going to be fully serious, okay? But who knows? Great things could come from this. Great things could come. Also, some really pretty dangerous things could come from it, too. You know, this book by Mearsheimer, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, basically shows that, you know, you're dealing with psychopathic entities that can't tolerate each other. And that's how we end up with things like World War One, World War Two, and various other wars that have happened. How we end up with the Ukraine War could be how we end up with World War Three. Then again, this is all part of the cut and thrust of the human animal. So you know, not that I want World War III to come, but it sorted a lot of problems out, wouldn't it? I always remember listening to James Delling, before James Dellingpole went, truly went off the deep end. He had Norman Tebbit on, the old kind of bruiser, Margaret Thatcher's bruiser. And Tebbit at one point just said, look, when all is said and done, we need to have a big war that'll sort things out. Right. And he just came out and said it. Yeah, big war will sort things out. And there's bound to be people within the establishment who are thinking that, you know, because trust me, if we have World War III, all of the stuff about trans toilets and woke and immigration and all of these issues will just, they'll just vanish because, you know, the chickens will be coming home to roost. And in those sorts of conditions, only people who really care about these countries will be prepared to fight for them. You know, nobody wants to fight for these people, for these leaders. But trust me, like, right, let's pretend for a second that the Russians were mad enough to attack British soil. All this talk will go out the window. I've said before, if we actually go to war, all this analysis we do will be gone overnight. You won't be allowed to. You just won't be allowed to not be for the war project, for the defense project. If it's a matter of, you know, to quote Powell and Pressburger, life and death, there's just no way. You know, and you saw what happened to Gonzalo Lira in Ukraine, right? I mean, it was tragic what happened, but also the reality is that Ukraine was at war fighting for its survival. And in those sorts of conditions, you know, that they just wouldn't, you know, whether you call yourself a dissident or right wing or left wing or a pacifist or anti-war or whatever, you wouldn't even have the option. You wouldn't have the option. The question would be, what are you doing to help the war effort? Okay. And it could come. It could come. Hopefully it doesn't, but it could. All right, folks. Hopefully this was interesting. I mean, what is Europe's best defense strategy? I mean, it's what I said. I mean, it's actually doing the rearming. It's actually pledging the money to do it right now. But that's not enough. It needs to reindustrialize, and it needs to be able to, you know, produce its own guns, produce its own, and not be reliant on foreign imports. You know, can't buy its arms from Russia, obviously, but also shouldn't buy its arms from America or indeed any countries in the Middle East. It needs to supply its own weapons, right? That's the basic security position. And it seems like, I mean, from that statement from von der Leyen, it seems like they're going to go there as well. But we'll only know if they're truly serious if they dump the net zero crap, because that is holding us, well, that's holding Europe back. I think there's a separate video as to what Britain should do. You know, Britain's always kind of stood a little bit apart from Europe. In recent history, it's been America's point man in Europe. Starmer seems to be like aligning us with the EU at the moment. Whether that is the best idea for us is a conversation for another day. I would love to see Britain just take a time out, as I've talked about before. You know, I feel like Britain more than any other country needs a time out. But anyway, all topics for another day. Hopefully this was interesting. Pick up a course, subscribe to Morgoth on his YouTube and his Substack, and I'll see you again next week. If you liked this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.